Coming up next, Upstate's HealthLink on Air. On this week's program, we talk about the potential threat of the Zika virus.
It's been reported for other viruses, classically like rubella, can give you microcephaly, but hasn't been reported with these family of viruses, and so this makes it another unique feature of Zika virus.
Plus, the challenges facing the new president of Upstate Medical University.
How should we sort of organize medical care? We need to reflect what we believe in our principles in the practice of medicine.
And preventing colon cancer and what we can do now.
As far as different types of screening, colonoscopy, yes, it is a quote-unquote gold standard. There's a virtual colonoscopy, which is a CAT scan. There is no bad colon cancer screening test. They're just different ones.
All that and a piece from our healing muse, and that's all coming up right after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll meet the new president of Upstate Medical University and discover her vision for healthcare in the 21st century. Plus, we'll get an important update on the latest in colon cancer prevention. But first, the Zika virus is wreaking havoc in South America and now has arrived on our shores. What do we need to know? The World Health Organization recently declared the Zika virus and its suspected link to birth defects an international public health emergency, a move that signals the seriousness of the outbreak and gives countries new tools to fight it. Here with more on all of this and the risk it poses to the U.S. is Dr. Timothy Endy, professor of medicine, microbiology, and immunology, and the division chief of infectious disease at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Endy. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thank you for inviting me.
Let's first begin by explaining what is the Zika virus.
Well, Zika virus, as it states, is a virus. So it's a very small replicating piece of material that is can be spread in a variety of ways, but Zika virus in particular was first isolated in 1947 and was isolated in Uganda outside of Entebbe in the Zika forest, and that's how it's got its name, Zika virus. And it was done through the Rockefeller Institute's surveillance program for yellow fever, and they isolated the virus from a febrile monkey that was part of that surveillance program. And they did some characterization. They realized that the virus was very different from yellow fever, different from dengue viruses, which were endemic there. And so it earned its own name. So Zika virus is a RNA virus. So it uses RNA as a genetic code, and it's very similar.
That's genetic material, RNA.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Very similar to dengue virus, West Nile virus, Japanese encephalitis virus. So it's in this whole family of what they call the flaviviruses.
So was there a concern back in 47, if it were found in a monkey, was there a concern that it would affect humans back then?
Well, the history is to me, is fascinating, and you have to go back to the original publications. But like any new virus, I'm sure the investigators and Dr. Dick at that time isolated the virus, was very excited to discover a brand new virus. But the next question is, you know, what does it mean? There's a lot of viruses out there that don't affect humans. So the first thing that he did was he developed some diagnostic tests, and he looked around the population and says, well, do people have antibody to this virus? Is there evidence for
infection?
And he did. He found that there was what we call a seroprevalence. The percentage of people who have antibody to it was about 20%.
So that people had experienced this disease, whether or not they were even aware of it.
Exactly. But they really didn't find a clinical illness. So the next question was, well, are they actually developing some symptoms? And he found patients who had fever, muscle aches, that were not dengue or yellow fever, and he found that it was from Zika virus. Probably the most interesting study, though, was done in the 1950s. And an investigator in the tradition of really good medicine injected himself with the Zika virus.
We hear about that all through history of medicine.
Exactly. Just, you know, it's you know, it's quite amazing that they can do that. But he injected himself and he developed fever, headache, pain behind the eye, muscle aches. He was able to isolate the virus from his blood. He broke out into a rash and then he got better. And that was the first clinical description of acute Zika infection.
So exactly, well, first let's get to how it's transmitted, because mm-hmm. I think that's a great concern to a lot of people. Mm-hmm. There have been talks about, I mean, obviously it's mosquito-borne largely.
Correct.
So explain how that works. So if it's in a monkey population, let's say, is it that the mosquito bites the monkey and then the mosquito gets the virus and then the mosquito goes on and bites the human? Is that how it works?
Well, that's how it works for Zika virus and dengue virus. So there is a monkey, mosquito, back to monkey. So if we pretend we're looking out through the eyes of a female mosquito, which is the one that takes blood meals that's needed for the protein to develop eggs and such. The female mosquito sees a monkey in a tree and goes and feeds it, takes a blood meal. If that monkey happened to have virus in his blood from Zika, then the mosquito will take that in and the virus starts replicating the mosquito and concentrates in the salivary glands. Then usually after 10 to 14 days, the mosquito is infected, will then go on to take another blood meal from a non-infected monkey and then transmit the virus to that. So that's actually called what we call a sylvatic cycle, monkey-mosquito-monkey. Now, if man is there and he's chopping down a tree or he's collecting bananas, the mosquito is not very picky about the blood meals that it takes. So it sees a human there, takes a blood meal, and it's infected. It will then transmit it to a human. The human goes home, and then it starts the cycle from mosquitoes to human back to mosquitoes.
But there also have been talks, I mean, there's been talk recently that this also can be transmitted human to human without the mosquito vector through sexual contact. Is there enough data to support this at this point?
That's one of the very unique features of this Zika virus. So it's unlike its other cousins in the flavivirus family. And having this ability to spread sexually. There is a distant cousin, and that's hepatitis C, which is in the flavivirus, that can be sexually transmitted, so that there seems to be some inherent characteristics about that. So Zika virus has been now established, I think, in about 5 cases where there's been documented male to female partner sexual transmission. And they've also discovered that the virus concentrates in the male semen, so that it allows transmission during sexual intercourse is the current theory.
Do they have any idea, though? I mean, let's get to what the disease itself, for the most part, doesn't pose a major threat to life. Is that correct?
That's entirely correct. So there have been historically at least 3 huge outbreaks before this current, you know, outbreak in Brazil and in South America. And there have been no deaths reported for Zika. The majority of infections, almost 50% or more, are subclinical, meaning that people never really know that they're infected or get sick or have a fever. Very few, just a handful, were in the hospital with severe symptoms.
But the major concern really has been this issue of microcephaly, or basically a reduction in the size of the skull or the head of developing fetus.
Correct.
And then brain, all kinds of developmental problems and neurological problems following that.
Correct. So children who are born with severely diminished size of their head, microcephaly, does occur in the United States. It occurs to the world, but it's a very rare occurrence. And it's been reported for other viruses, classically like rubella virus can give you microcephaly. Cytomegalovirus, but hasn't been reported with these family of viruses. And so this makes it another unique feature of Zika virus, these reported increase, dramatic increase, 100-fold increase of microcephaly reported in Brazil.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with infectious disease specialist Dr. Timothy Endy, and we're talking about Zika virus. So that is the major concern, I guess, or the thing that's making people frightened. Mm-hmm. And clearly this whole idea of sexual transmission puts another level of concern into it, because obviously it's hard to protect yourself against mosquitoes, but that is still more, you know, you still have some methodology there. But this idea of how long the virus lasts in the blood, do we know that in terms of if someone were to be infected, let's say a male partner mm-hmm. infected, goes through the disease process, and then
later on has a sexual contact with a female partner, is it likely that that female partner could then receive the disease and harbor it, perhaps in a dormant state, until such time as she became pregnant?
Well, that's a very good question, and we don't know the exact answer, but we can speculate that this is a virus that's an acute infection, which means that there is a limit to the amount of reproduction. So it's unlike HIV, which is a chronic infection. So there is a limit. So we know that people who are acutely infected with Zika virus, that the levels of virus in their blood usually last between 7 to 10 days and then disappears once the body kicks it out of the system. And then they've been able to document Zika virus in urine and semen for about a month. So it does resolve over time, so it doesn't represent a chronic risk. It represents a risk during the acute period of infection.
So there is a time limit to it. So what is the CDC recommending these days? I mean, what are you telling your patients, and what's the overall kind of, you know, the current wisdom?
Well, first is education, so that the current outbreak, which was explosive in Brazil, is now affecting 10, 12 countries in South America, has spread into the Caribbean. There are now, I guess, 100 and some odd cases in Puerto Rico. There's been a woman reported with microcephaly in Hawaii that had visited Brazil during the first trimester. There have been reported cases in travelers returning back to the United States, but no documented transmission within the United States. So the recommendations are for travelers going to these heavy transmission areas to be careful, to protect themselves by wearing insect repellents, which usually contain, you know, DEET containing compounds that you can spray or rub on.
And these mosquitoes, I'm sorry to interrupt you, mm-hmm. are active during the day as well as night. Am I correct?
Well, daytime mosquitoes. So the mosquito is an Aedes aegypti, mm-hmm. which are tropical, subtropical mosquito that also spreads chikungunya, also spreads dengue. And they are daytime feeders. So they like to live in the day and feed during the day, but they also like to shade. So you're at the beach, you're under an umbrella or a tree stand, you know, away from the sun, and that's where the mosquitoes like to feed on you. And that's really a good time to wear the repellent or to cover yourself with some loose clothing to protect yourself from the bite of mosquito. So the recommendations are to protect yourself if you're traveling those areas. And there are special high-risk populations. So the CDC and the WHO are currently recommending if you're planning to become pregnant or are pregnant, especially the high risk during your first trimester, is to avoid traveling to those areas that are currently reporting outbreaks of Zika.
And there's a whole listing on the CDC website, I would think, of the countries you want to avoid. How about the Olympics? There's been talk about people, again, mm-hmm. what's the recommendation there?
So the big concern is the Olympics is a high density. Certainly Rio and parts of Brazil are highly endemic for Aedes aegypti and the Zika outbreak. And the CDC came out with a recommendation for any women who are planning to become pregnant or are pregnant to avoid traveling to the Olympics.
And that's irrespective of if you're pregnant, if you're at the end of your pregnancy, mm-hmm. theoretically the baby, you know, their development is pretty well set at that point.
Correct.
But we don't know what the potential problems are.
You know, there's a lot of studies going on. Our group is planning to try to do some studies in Ecuador. Is trying to answer that question. But if it's like other viruses that produce birth abnormalities, the first trimester is the highest risk.
So basically the bottom line at this point is, well, I know the Aedes aegypti also exists in Florida and maybe other places in this country.
Louisiana, Texas, Southern California all have Aedes aegypti.
So they could become so-called hotspots, theoretically.
Be. Absolutely.
And is that just a matter of time and watchful waiting? I mean, is there any methodology that they could be or should be using at this point to decrease that likelihood?
I think South Florida, especially Key West and now Fort Lauderdale, which has Aedes aegypti, is a good example. A traveler came from the Caribbean with a dengue infection, which is, as we stated, a cousin of Zika. A mosquito, he went to Key West, a mosquito fed off of him, and then it got into the population of mosquitoes. And so they've had dengue every year now, despite very aggressive spraying and killing off of mosquito eggs and such. So if that same patient was a Zika-carrying patient and went to South Florida, you could potentially see the same thing happen.
Is there some effort today, and I know you're working on a virus, on a vaccine for dengue, mm-hmm. is there some effort today to do some kind of genetic modifications? I know I heard something, and we're going to run out of time. So, but to actually put mosquitoes out there that will prevent proliferation?
Yeah, so I've been a consultant to some groups. One uses what's called a Wolbachia infected mosquito. Another one is a riddle mosquito, which is basically can't really regenerate. So
it's like sterilized.
It's sterilized, exactly. So there's a lot of potential plans out there for that.
And you yourself are working on a dengue vaccine. Is that coming along?
Well, yeah, we are developing a model to test dengue vaccines and also providing some consultation on a Zika vaccine as well.
Fabulous. Thank you so much for coming in. You're always a fount of information and wisdom.
Thank
My
you.
Guest has been Dr. Timothy Endes, Professor of Medicine, Microbiology, and Immunology, and the Division Chief of Infectious Disease at Upstate Medical University. Coming up next, the new president of Upstate Medical University and her vision for healthcare today. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Upstate Medical University has a new president. Dr. Danielle LaRocque Arena is the first woman to lead the university and comes to us from her role as the chair of the Department of Pediatrics at Maimonides Medical Center and vice president of Maimonides Infants and Children's Hospital of Brooklyn in New York City. She also served as a professor of pediatrics at Albert Einstein College of Medicine at Yeshiva University in New York City. And she's here with us now. Welcome, Dr. LaRocque Arena. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning.
So you're new to Central New York. How do you like it so far?
Oh, we love it. We love it. My husband and I have moved up here. And really, we're New Yorkers. So it was not a stretch to come to Central New York. We've obviously been here for various reasons, and it's beautiful here. Syracuse has a great deal of history, and that was palpable when we came and through the decision process of moving up here and accepting this position.
That's great, you know, and we haven't had too bad a winter so far.
I say that I brought the warm weather with me.
That's good. We like that. So let's have an opportunity for you to tell us a little bit about yourself. Where were you born and raised?
So I was born in Port-au-Prince, Haiti, which is a small island that's the island of Hispaniola, which is Haiti on one side and the Dominican Republic on the other side. Haiti is a francophone country, meaning that the primary languages, there are two, are French and Creole. And I moved to this country at the age of 7, so very young. And second grade I did in Queens, New York.
I'm from Queens as well. And so you basically lived in New York City most of your early career in terms of education.
Sure. I'm a public school kid.
Mm-hmm,
so I did my elementary and intermediate school. They were piloting intermediate schools at the time, and high school in Queens. And then did my first couple of years at Fordham University and a year abroad in England, and actually graduated from UCLA, which is the university system in Los Angeles, which is also a public
So at one point you moved out to California?
I did.
To finish your career.
Sure.
So give us a feeling for why you chose to go into medicine. Was there something in your background? Was there something in your family life?
You know, that's interesting. So yes, neither of my parents was in medicine, but actually my grandfather in Haiti in a small village called Benet was actually a physician. And my grandmother, who was a teacher, extremely bright, he and she ran actually a pharmacy because you couldn't survive in medicine in Haiti at the time because you really did have to give most of your services free because you were the only physician in town, so that was not negotiable. So, yeah.
So in seeing that or thinking about that, you saw that potentially inspirational for you?
Actually, unfortunately not. My grandfather, I knew him. He died very early, so that I really remember when I was six, I remember his death. But of course, I knew that he was a physician. My grandmother lived with us. She moved when we moved from Haiti to New York. My grandmother actually accompanied my brothers and me. And so she was a big influence and had obviously been a partner to my grandfather as a physician, and so I think had a great impact.
Why pediatrics?
Pediatrics was an interesting choice for me. My training was at UCLA, so I went to the UCLA School of Medicine, and we had both the tertiary quaternary care center at UCLA, and then a number of fantastic other clinical sites. The two that stand out for me are Harbor UCLA and Martin Luther King Hospital. And they were both in areas that had demographically very tough conditions, but extremely robust education. And in both those settings, I did my clerkship in pediatrics at Martin Luther King, and I did what's called the sub-I, which is a more intense month at Harbor UCLA in the neonatal intensive care unit, and I just loved it.
So pediatrics became the thing, and then you went on and you did a residency and further training beyond.
Sure. So the progress for medicine is you do your basic 4 years, then you decide what specialty, and in my case it was pediatrics. And I wanted to come back east. So even though my husband and I had been in Los Angeles for 6 years, we really wanted to migrate back east. And Philadelphia, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania, is one of the premier programs. And I fell in love with that city and with the program. So I was fortunate to be an intern and resident there. And I also was a Robert Wood Johnson General Academic Pediatric Fellow there, focusing on clinical research and primary care.
So in doing all of that work, obviously there were some things that tugged at you, you know, during that kind of very formative time in your professional career. What were the kinds of things that you noticed or felt very strongly about even way back then?
So way back, my undergraduate degree is in chemistry. So I loved chemistry, particularly organic, but chemistry, but I love chemistry. And actually my first research was on lead poisoning and calcium status that sort of melded the two. But lead poisoning, as you know, the recent issues in Flint, Michigan,
sure,
et cetera, that has a very important social context and prevention. So lead has an unfortunate history in our country in that it is a toxin that is a neurotoxin and affects many different areas of the body. But prevention is the key. So, you know, screening when folks are asymptomatic is unfortunately too late because you're detecting lead already in the body. So in pediatrics, the reason I gravitated towards that was certainly the rigor that pediatrics demands, but also the opportunities for real prevention. Okay.
To make a difference.
You make a difference at every level, right? I mean, in the care of geriatric patients, you make a difference. But I think the emphasis on public health, on population. Remember, I came from a very poor country, so that was in my background to understand how poverty can be absolutely crushing in terms of the opportunities for individuals and populations. So that was always critical in my assessment of where I wanted to take my career.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with Upstate's new president, Dr. Danielle LaRocque Arena. And we're talking about her life, her interests, and her hopes for Upstate under her leadership. We'll get to that in a minute. But so you've done a lot in the world of medical education. A lot of your more recent years mm-hmm. have been spent in educating medical students, residents, all of that. Tell us about that. What is particularly important to you in that?
I think, again, my background is as a clinician, so I always say everything that I do is grounded in the clinical work. But I've always integrated education and research in that. And so if you look back at my first faculty appointment, which was at Columbia University in Harlem, I felt very strongly that the rigor that I had seen at the University of Pennsylvania needed to come with me. And I was surrounded by incredible individuals in those days at Columbia and at Harlem, that we needed to translate that also to more impoverished areas. So Harlem Hospital has a long history, and I wanted to continue to do medical education in those settings, because you have to have real fidelity to the way care is practiced and what you teach.
And right? Cultural sensitivity, I would think, as well.
It's even beyond cultural sensitivity. It is a reframing of what's just, so that if there are things that you're teaching about the way that medicine needs to be delivered, the students need to be able to see that in real life. Okay, there can't be a disconnect between what they see in the delivery of care to underserved populations, for example, and what we tell them is the right way to practice. So I think embedding, so I had medical students from the very beginning of my career, okay? And obviously residents. I went to teaching programs and academic programs. So that was fundamental. I've never been in a setting without trainees. Okay. And then when I went from Harlem and Columbia to Mount Sinai for a decade, I actually developed fellowship programs in general academic pediatrics and internal medicine, where every fellow actually had a master's in public health, emerged from the program with a master's in public health. And we trained more than a couple of, we trained over 20 fellows during that decade. And there it was to continue their training in terms of clinical research, okay? A role of epidemiology was important, understanding research design, and understanding the importance of evaluating what you do in the clinical setting was really important. And, you know, things like community-based participatory research, health services research, all of that became very important in the training. So I've trained many fellows. I've also trained many fellows in child abuse pediatrics, which is the latest specialty, which was sub-boarded in 2009.
I didn't realize it was that recent.
It is that recent, meaning child abuse has existed forever. And many of us have done child abuse work in team-based care, which perhaps we'll get a chance to talk about. But actually, the American Board of Pediatrics decided to actually require a certification exam, which I took and many others. We were the first, I think the first 200 folks or so, who took the certification exam for this as a specialty. And I had the privilege of training about five or six fellows in that new specialty, so that the specialty can continue beyond those of us who really learned it through practice.
So did this kind of concept or this interest in all of this, you know, this idea of training medical students in all of the epidemiology and of how poverty affects health and all of those things, that led you in some ways to become involved in public policy.
That's correct.
So
that's
you were part of the U.S. Public Health Service primary care policy. You were a fellow for them.
Yes.
Very briefly.
Sure.
Just tell us a little bit.
Each medical organization across interprofessional had the opportunity to send a representative from their organization to Washington for a six-month fellowship as a policy fellow. So I had the honor of representing the American Academy of Pediatrics. And in fact, the things we talked about came to pass in the past decade or so, which had to do with comprehensiveness of care and the medical home, and also care coordination and compassionate care and continuous care. So that policy says, you know, how should we sort of organize medical care? And I alluded to that in the training of our students, that we need to reflect what we believe in our principles in the practice of medicine.
And have a team approach as well.
But there are policies that have led to a pretty fragmented healthcare system.
I'm going to stop you there because I don't want to run out of time. What I want to do is, if you looked into your crystal ball, where do you see medical education / healthcare delivery going? Briefly,
right,
in the 21st century.
I think in the 21st century, it has to be driven by team-based care. That means it's interprofessional, that we no longer train in silos because we know it's more effective. It has to involve robust data. It has to involve information technology. It has to importantly involve patients and their families at the center of care. You know, for each one of us, what's important in our health is very personal, and medicine needs to gravitate towards patient-centered and family-centered care, and then use the latest science, genomics, genetics, how do we do precision medicine, et cetera, to individualize that care and yet keep the broader framework of family and community in the context.
Very well said. Perfectly said. Thank you so much. That was wonderful. My guest has been Upstate Medical University's new president, Dr. Danielle LaRocca-Arena, and we've had a wonderful opportunity to visit with you. Thanks so very much for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. March is Colon Cancer Awareness Month, and the American Cancer Society and Upstate Medical University are teaming up with Kinney Drugs to advance colorectal cancer prevention in central and northern New York. Here with more on all of this is Dr. Leslie Coleman from the Upstate Cancer Center, who is also the medical officer for the American Cancer Society for New York and New Jersey. Welcome, Dr. Coleman. So tell us all a little bit about this initiative. What is this initiative?
Yes, the American Cancer Society has a major national focus called 80% by 2018. The intent is to make sure that all eligible adults are screened for colorectal cancer 80% by 2018. And one of the projects that Upstate is working on with the American Cancer Society is a project with Kinney Drugs. This will be the third year that we have had this project. During the month of March, Kinney Drug will give out stool testing kits for free to eligible people who come into their store. These will be then developed and tested, and the person will receive a letter from the American Cancer Society if there are no abnormalities, if there is no blood detected. That's what the testing tests for. And if there is some sort of abnormality, the patient and their primary care doctor will be contacted by Upstate Cancer Center for advice and discussion as to what the appropriate next step would be.
Do they have any idea of, like, what are their hopes in terms of who they'll reach in terms of this outreach? It's for just for the month of March.
It's correct? For the month of March, and the pharmacists will actually screen the recipients of the kits to make sure that they are over 50, have not been tested recently, are less than the upper age limit, I think 80, and have no other reasons they should not have this particular test. There are many ways of testing for colorectal cancer, and this is one of them that can be easily utilized in a setting like this. The other part of the 80% by 2018 is for businesses, organizations, and employers to take the pledge to do everything they can to make sure that 80% of their patients or their employees are tested. And Upstate has taken this pledge for both its employees and its patients, and so have many other local businesses and large employers. And in the first part of month, there'll be a major press conference to announce this.
Well, thank you so much for coming in and sharing that with us. So it's my understanding that people can, at no cost to them, go to Kinney Drugs during the month of March, receive these basically stool testers, and then they can return it to Kinney Drugs and get some response.
They can actually mail it in.
Wonderful. Thanks so much for coming in. My guest has been Dr. Leslie Coleman. She's from the Upstate Cancer Center, who's also the medical officer for the American Cancer Society for New York and New Jersey. Very important information. Thanks again.
Thanks, Linda.
Next up, an update on colon cancer screening.
What do you need to know? You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen here with you. Colorectal cancer, commonly known as colon cancer, is the third leading cause of cancer-related deaths in the United States among men and women, and is expected to cause nearly 50,000 deaths this year alone. But colorectal cancer screening saves lives. Here with more on all of this is Dr. David Halloran. He's a colorectal surgeon and the section chief of surgery at Upstate's community campus. Welcome, Dr. Halloran. So colorectal cancer is a killer, but screening for it can really save lives. Tell us about that.
As with all cancers, and particularly colorectal cancer, the earlier you find a cancer, the better your survival rates. What's different with colon cancer as opposed to other cancers, you know, those that you can find as little specks nowadays and are treatable, you can actually prevent this by going back far enough in the history of it, and it is usually a benign lesion or a polyp at some point in its stage. And if you find it then, you can remove it often, most of the time endoscopically without an operation, and that is not only, it's not curative, it's actually preventative, because you take the polyp out and put it in a jar, you don't get the cancer.
And it's done.
So
who is most at risk? I mean, what are the factors that play a role in people developing colon cancer? I mean, you suggest that it has a history, that it may start as something benign, as a little polyp, a little pimple or something in the colon, and then really become a full-blown cancer. So who is most at risk for this?
The biggest risk factor is mostly just age. 93% of cancers occur in people over the age of 50. Now, in addition to that, two other independent risk factors. One is family history, which you don't have control over, but it's a very important piece of information to know. But as far as behavioral things go, smoking, interestingly, is an independent risk factor for colon cancer.
Really?
As is obesity. So those are things that can be controlled.
So you should stop smoking. You should maintain a healthy weight if you're talking about prevention.
Correct.
And so let's get to the screening then. So at what point, I mean, what are the recommendations now on a national basis for how early people should begin to screen for colon cancer?
For colon cancer, nationally, for average risk people, meaning people without symptoms and people without a family history, age 50. There's some suggestion that this may be moved forward to age 45 in the Afro-American population, but age 50 is usually the standard for plain old Joe Blow.
And that's for
risk.
Any type of screening for colon cancer.
Any type of screening, and there are many different types available.
Now, we were just saying that colon cancer is often silent, but if you were having symptoms, what would you be having that would indicate to you that, oh, I should really go see a physician, I should check this out?
Well, the most common symptom is bleeding, either on an occult stool test or just overt blood. The most common sand trap to avoid is seeing a little bit of bright red bleeding and assuming it's something not cancer, like hemorrhoids. Probably statistically, probably is hemorrhoids. You don't know that until you get it examined. And early on, tumors produce, you know, the earlier the tumor, the less symptoms it produces. Bleeding may be the first, and I'm very spastic about people come in to my office with that complaint. Bleeding, you get quote-unquote change in bowels, which is either going too often or too little. Smaller size stools, as it progresses and spreads, you get weight loss.
Pain, know, in the stomach ever?
You get abdominal pain, yes.
So basically, let's talk a little bit about what the various screening options are. I mean, obviously, the gold standard is the colonoscopy. How often should people get a colonoscopy after the age of 50 or beginning at the age of 50?
Begin at the age of 50, again, for average risk patients, every 10 years. So you're talking once a decade having a colonoscopy. The good news with this mass screening, I tell people I divide my career into the pre and post Katie Couric era. Mm-hmm. I think what she's done for this disease and promotion and advocacy is fantastic. And the number of new colon cancers from 2002 to 2012 is down by 30%.
Really?
That's why it is now the number three cause for cancer death instead of a decade ago, the second most common cause for cancer
death. Yes, I found that actually.
So it actually does work. This is not some kind of fantasy. This is actually proven it works.
It saves lives.
It saves lives and prevents cancers. But as far as different types of screening, colonoscopy, yes, it is a quote-unquote gold standard. There's a virtual colonoscopy, which is a CAT scan.
So talk about that a little bit. So what does that actually mean?
Virtual colonoscopy is a CAT scan. It requires a full bowel prep.
So you do the same preparation you would for a
colonoscopy, correct.
But you go under a CAT scan.
You go to a CAT scan. They instill some air into the bowel to distend it. And it's not a bad test. I mean, I'm of the thought mindset that there is no bad colon cancer screening tests. They're just different ones. It doesn't pick up a lot of the small polyps, about 50% of polyps under 8 millimeters.
So it can miss things.
It can miss polyps. I mean, so can colonoscopy. There's no one test that's 100%, but that is still the best test. As it virtual, it misses it. Plus, and more practically, if it sees something, it doesn't biopsy to remove it.
So, in other words, you'd still then have to go and have the full colonoscopy.
Right. There's the old-fashioned flexible sigmoidoscopy, which was promoted 20 years ago as a screening method. And again, it's not a bad screening method. We'll pick up a lot of polyps or tumors or cancers, not all of them, maybe about half of them.
But does that also involve the prep?
It involves less of a prep. You could do that with just two fleet enemas before the exam.
Because it doesn't go through the entire colon.
Right.
It just does
a
small section.
Just the lower third of the colon. Other tests, there's the old-fashioned fecal occult blood test, which has been replaced by the FIT test, which is more specific for human hemoglobin.
So it's chemically looking for a particular finding
within
not
the stool.
Just the blood.
This is the occult blood. This is blood you may not see, which is more common in lesions that are above the bowel and in the upper portion of the bowel.
And those are a simple stool sample, right?
Correct. That's something they do at home and usually mail back or drop off at the doctor's office.
What about something, this new test that's coming out called the Cologuard? What exactly is that, and is it an effective test?
According to their literature, it's supposed to be 92% effective for finding large polyps and or cancers. I've used that off and on. I've had some false positives so far. It's not a bad test. I think it's fascinating that you can find, abnormal DNA in the stool. I think this whole area of genomics and DNA testing is I think the whole future of a lot of this.
So it is still a stool sample, but
correct.
It's a more highly sensitive, or it's
right.
Looking for, as you said, DNA.
DNA in the stool, correct.
So isn't it, I guess, if you were to recommend to someone what the protocol should be after age 50, I mean, you have this variety of tests. How do you pick which? How does someone decide which to use?
Well, again, I'm the first to admit I have a very limited vision of life in my practice. But if they come to my office, I'm recommending they get a colonoscopy, age appropriate. And if not, and some people don't want tests, and sometimes, I'm not seeing everyone. Obviously, people that want to have any that kind of test I'm not seeing.
Or they don't want to see. They don't want to have an invasive test.
Or they want to have an invasive test. And there are risks. There's no free lunch. There's risks of bleeding if you take out a polyp. There's risks of perforation, which are rare, but do happen. And I know since it is such a popular test now, you probably through a friend of a friend know someone who had a test and had a problem. I mean, I hear that not uncommonly in the office, but it is still a good test. I think you have to talk to the patient. I think there's a conversation patients should have with their doctors. The other concern is, everyone knows when to start screening. No one knows really when to stop. And there was a paper floated a few years ago saying that after 75, don't do any routine screening. And I have a problem with that. What's routine screening? 75 is the new 65. People are out bicycling, everything else.
Living into their 90s and 100s.
Yeah. And they're still getting everything else done, and I can't understand why you wouldn't want it, the number three colon the cause for cancer deaths addressed at some point when you're 76 or 78. So I think it's a discussion. I mean, there are people that come in and they have multiple morbidity, they have high morbidity, and you don't want to put them through a colonoscopy.
So they may have other conditions that would make a colonoscopy more threatening difficult.
Other than the question of should you do any test, what are you going to do when you find it? But if you are going to do a screening test, then maybe you go to a less invasive test.
But the bottom line is, are all these tests, including the colonoscopy, are not 100%, but they all can contribute to a picture.
Correct. If I have someone who's at high risk and I say, I don't want to do an invasive test on them, and you do a non-invasive test, and it's negative, good. But if it's positive, it gives you more, I think, thrust to go ahead and a reason to go ahead and do something.
So these stool tests and the Cologuard and that type of thing, can those be done or should those be done annually? I know the colonoscopy is done every 10 years, but do you recommend?
The stool test can be done annually. The Cologuard, I think, is every 3 or 5 years. It's a fairly expensive test, and I think often it's pending the insurance prior approval.
Mm-hmm. But basically, isn't it that the right test is the one the patient will undertake?
Absolutely. I think
and any test is better than none at all.
Any test is better than no test, correct.
So let's get to a little bit of time. We have just some time left, actually. When you talk about colon cancer, what are the key, let's assume you find it early. As you said, you can literally remove it and there's no sequelae. There's nothing further needs to be done, no chemo, no radiation, nothing. If you fully take out an early stage polyp, is that correct?
Early stage cancer, correct.
Yes, right. In early stage cancers. Because you take out a polyp perhaps during a colonoscopy, you have to then test it for pathology. And if it was cancer, you can be comfortable at that point?
It depends. It depends on what they call the Haggett's level. It depends on the age of the patient.
Okay.
A 40-year-old with an invasive, with a cancer and a polyp, I might want to have a resection. An 80-year-old, you may be happy just
removing the cancer. Yep. So if there's, let's talk about the different stages just briefly. So when we talk about cancer, it's staged based on what?
It's a stage based on depth of invasion of the cancer through the bowel wall.
Through the amount of tissue, additional tissue
right,
involved.
The bowel wall has an inner layer, a muscular layer, an outer layer, a surrounding fat, and also the lymph nodes. Now the lymph nodes are really the break point for a lot of treatment options. Radiation therapy is really never an option for rectal cancer. It is sometimes used for, it is an option for rectal cancer sometimes, if needed, if it goes through the wall or had lymph nodes. Radiation is never an option for colon cancer above the rectum, but if it goes into the lymph nodes, then chemotherapy is advised.
So surgery is largely the majority, the mainstay.
It remains primarily a surgical disease, correct. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are people who come in who have no lymph nodes, you resect them, and they're done. Okay, they still need to be watched, okay, but they're done. Chemotherapy, though, is for people who have lymph nodes involved, this is now pretty standard over the last 20-plus years. It is a big impact on people who have lymph node involvement as far as survivorship. And as a matter of fact, a recent
study...
That
it has improved survivorship.
From 1990 to 2010, the improvement for survival for colon cancer is up by 46%. I mean, I hate to use the word huge, but it's a very large improvement over the years. So it is helpful. I mean, it's helpful if you have it early, but if you don't, don't throw the baby out with the bathwater because it is a curable disease even at a moderate stage.
So that is extremely hopeful, I would think, for people to know. I mean, obviously you don't want to let it get to the point where you're into stage 2 or 3 cancer, but the reality is that it's changed quite dramatically from a killer historically to something that really basically can be cured.
It can be cured at a lot of different stages. And also from a... for the rectal cancer, I think one of the biggest fears that people have in the back of their mind is if I have cancer, I may need a colostomy. Nowadays, even if you just looked at the rectal cancers, only about 15% of rectal cancers, that's 15% would ever require a permanent colostomy. You're talking about something that is very, very low down on the sphincters. As a matter of fact, one of my issues I have are people getting screening, that just a rectal exam can detect a lot of lower rectal cancers. And so people are, when you talk about, well, this advanced screening, they're not even getting either a blood test or a rectal exam on a doctor's visit.
So I hear the bottom line here is screening, screening, and more screening. And with that, it looks like we could really turn the tide in the fact that it'll be the 4th, 5th, or 6th killer.
Hopefully soon.
Thank you so much, Dr. Halloran. My guest has been Dr. David Halloran. He's a colorectal surgeon and the section chief of surgery at Upstate's Community Campus. Once again, thanks for coming in. I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on AIM. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Thank you, Linda. It may seem contradictory to say that thoughts of our own death can be comforting, But Lynn Hoggard uses her own appreciation for French philosopher Blaise Pascal to show us the beauty in such thinking. Hoggard's most recent book is a memoir, Motherland, Stories and Poems from Louisiana. Here is her poem, Leaning into Pascal, which begins with a line from Pascal, "Belief is a wise wager." It's not as if we have the choice of a bodily ascension, drawn into eternity by a whirlwind like Elijah, or lifted into clouds like Jesus. We'll all die of something, and much of what we are will stay right here. More than likely, we won't choose the time or mode of exit, yet we face that knowledge not like people of spirit, but like materialists, locking into earth, skidding the backs off our heels, jamming our fingernails with dirt and tree bark, trying to stay unchanged. But if we trust the spirit, we'll turn and walk toward the glimmering haze the way a swimmer glides into the sea, anticipating the buoyant lift into another element. If there is no other destination, we'll fall into Earth's particles. If there is, we'll float, then maybe change to plankton, porpoises, seagulls, rain, or even opening air.
Thank you for joining us for HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we learn all about bone marrow transplantation and how it is saving lives, plus the powerful scientific connection between your emotions and your appetite, and all about 3D mammography. If you'd like to listen again to tonight's show, you can find a podcast of it on iTunes. Just search for HealthLink on Air, that's all one word. And to keep up with all the goings-on at Upstate, you can look for us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter or check out the What's Up at Upstate blog at upstate.edu/whatsup. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.